Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Tonight's topic is census and sensibility, understanding Alameda's 2010 census results and how it might impact the region's planning and community development. This March, Alameda County's census released its results showing that in the past 10 years, Oakland lost approximately 33,000 blacks and gained 10,000 whites. Alameda County overall gained 93,000 Asians. To some, this kind of demographic change is a shock, while to others, it's not surprising at all. But what does it all mean? Are people leaving or being pushed out of Oakland's inner city? And how will these numbers impact philanthropy, community building and planning, regional equity, and government policy? Joining me in the studio tonight to answer these questions and more are Steve Spiker, the Director of Research and Technology at Urban Strategies Council, a social justice, community building, and support nonprofit based in Oakland. He leads the council's GIS mapping team, research, evaluation, and tech work, and he's active with local youth groups and campaigns to end human trafficking and modern slavery, and also runs the Stealing Beauty Photography. Thanks for being on our show tonight, Steve.
Sure.
We also are joined by Karen Chappell. She is an associate professor of city and regional planning at UC Berkeley and also serves as associate director of the Institute of Urban and Regional Development and the director of the Center for Community Innovation. Nice to have you here, Karen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And by phone, we have Carl Anthony. He's co-founder and former executive director of Urban Habitat Program, one of the nation's oldest environmental justice organizations. He was a Ford Foundation Program Officer in the Community and Resource Development Unit and has taught at UC Berkeley, Stanford, and Columbia Universities. He's also one of the nation's leading voices on regional equity and social justice, and he's co-founder with Paloma Pavel of the Breakthrough Communities Initiative. Good evening, Carl. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And lastly but not least, we have Paloma Pavel, the founder and president of Earth House and the director of strategic communications for the Sustainable Metropolitan Communities Initiative at the Ford Foundation. She's a frequent lecturer and keynote presenter nationally and internationally on the theory of living systems and urban sustainability. And she's the editor of Breakthrough Communities. Good evening, Paloma. Thank you for being on our show.
Thank you, Lauren. It's a pleasure to be here.
And of course, we'll be taking calls from you. We'd like to hear your thoughts and your opinions, so give us a call at 415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So the census, Steve Spiker, I'd like to start with you. You evidently do a lot of work on the actual numbers. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So tell me, maybe you can tell me a little bit about what you found out with this census and what it says and what it means.
Sure, that's a very broad range of things. So in Alameda County, our organization focuses most heavily on low-income communities of color. Those are the main communities that we work with and partner with and support. And so for us, there's a lot of implications with the new census data. Getting the first official snapshot of our population in 10 years is obviously a big important piece for cities, for county agencies that are trying to understand where the money is coming from the federal government, because a lot of money is tied to the census population. And so if your population drops, that means you'll have less of a federal dollar stream coming through to your community, which has an impact on social programs, libraries, all kinds of other programs are actually based on a federal funding scheme, which is tied to the census population. So with Oakland, losing population means a loss of several federal program dollars. So that has a real impact to us in a time where local county governments and city agencies are running out of money and are having budgeting issues. Having another reduced source of funding is definitely what we don't need right now. So Oakland on the table, for example, has a lot of budgeting measures, such as cutting a lot of the library staff and public works staff. And a lot of those programs are actually funded out of programs that are tied to federal population statistics, which is the census data where that comes in. So the drop in population in Oakland and Alameda County for us means, first of all, it means that there is actually going to be less money at the table for the county and the city to use for all the kinds of programs that are funded through a lot of federal programs. So it has an impact in that way. It also helps us to to tell a story about our community and what this means. So when we have a reduced diversity in our community, that means that there's a change in our culture and the population is not going to just look different, but if people have lower income that are moving out, the issue is for social services agencies and counties and philanthropy, if there are poorer folks in Oakland that are being pushed out of Oakland because of gentrification, where are those families moving to and what sort of supports do they have in the communities they're going to? If Oakland, for example, has a fairly dense infrastructure of nonprofits and government agencies that serve poorer communities, are the areas that these families are being pushed out to equally equipped to deal with families in need that are well below the federal poverty level? So it raises a lot of implications for regional planning. So are the city governments in place where people are moving to? Are they equipped to deal with this issue? And is that community ready to take on more folks that are moving out from issues of trauma, say foreclosure? A lot of families have moved out of Oakland into areas like Antioch and Stockton and Tracy because their houses have been lost to the foreclosure crisis. But those families are also moving in a situation of stress and trauma, and they're moving to communities that aren't necessarily used to dealing with families that are coming out of a traumatic situation like that and are struggling to get back on their feet. So there's a lot of implications for philanthropy as to how to support people in a very mobile community, and for local governments, are they really up to speed on how to deal with the needs that people have that are moving from areas like Oakland and Berkeley?
So I hear it's interesting because you're talking about numbers, but it seems like a lot of the information you just mentioned isn't necessarily in the numbers. It's more assumptions you're making. Is that true, or do the...
One of the issues that the census has right now is because it's only a short-form census that we have the results from right now, it doesn't give us things like the family mobility in the census data. And so that's necessary that we pull that data from other government data sources to be able to identify where are families moving. So foreclosure, for example, we can track where families are moving from foreclosure and be able to identify where they're actually moving to and what those communities look like. And so that's not actually a census data set, unfortunately, but the census data is the data that we have that tells us what is the real makeup of this community. But right now, with the census 2010, all we have is a very limited set of variables that came out of that census. And so we know how many people are in a community from certain ethnicities and the age of people. And that's really all we have right now from this first release of the census. So it doesn't give us a very deep, very broad perspective on who is in our community. So it may tell us right now that there were X number of people of this ethnicity that moved out of a certain region, but it doesn't tell us the income of the people that moved in to replace them. So we can make right now, there's a limitation to what we can say with the census 2010 data because it isn't the usual long-form census data which gave us things like place of birth, citizenship, issues around income and occupation and education levels. Right now, the census doesn't give us that. So we're still using for a lot of that old census data or the American Community Survey data, which Karen can certainly speak to, has a lot of limitations as to how we can really use it for planning across the region.
Okay, but you still are, but it's still being used.
It is.
Okay, and how does the data that came from this 2010 census compare to the one 10 years ago? Is it a similar picture?
In what way? There's a lot of...
In terms of the migration, in terms of the demographics of who's leaving, who's coming in.
So right now, the demographics of who's coming and going isn't available with the census 2010. Like I said, all we have available right now is the ethnicity and ages.
Okay.
We don't have things like education and income. So we really can't, from the census data right now, we can't tell too much more about what's changing
except
in our community
for the race.
Until June when the new data comes out, which will have a lot more rich information.
I see. But I guess then from what you do know, you know, in terms of the numbers we cited at the beginning of the show, mm-hmm. How is that similar or different than 10 years ago?
Karen would actually probably be a great resource on this. She's done a lot of interesting work on regional shifts as well.
Okay. Well, thank you for that segue. Thank you. Karen. Karen Chappell, you're an associate professor of city and regional planning at UC Berkeley. And help us out here.
Okay, so we've been following the dispersal, particularly of minority communities from the central cities, really over the last decade, and every bit of data we've gotten has sort of confirmed that there's been a big population shift, that the suburbs are diversifying, and that poverty is moving to the census, suburbs.
Oh, okay.
Excuse me. What we don't know is whether people are moving, first of all, out of choice or whether they're being displaced. That's the first thing we don't know. And it's very, very complicated. And we saw in the decade of the 2000s, we saw the Bush regime, the homeownership society, right, where the American dream became available through subprime lending to a lot more folks. And so suddenly people were moving out to the suburbs, and that's in part responsible for the shift. So that seems to be choice. I have this fabulous PhD student named Ann Martin who is looking at foreclosure in the Bay Area, and she's looking at where the foreclosed households have moved. And one of the very interesting things she's found among these households, which are mostly Latino and Vietnamese and Chinese, is that when they lose their home, the majority of them that are living out in the suburbs stay in the suburbs. They stay within 5 miles of their original house. And this echoes findings from a recent Urban Institute study of the NEE Casey Making Connections Initiative, which had a great data set looking at mobility and neighborhood change, and an Oakland case as well that Urban Strategies was involved with. And that study showed, again, that there's mobility. Part of it is out of choice. Part of it is forced displacement. But what seems to be happening is people seem to want to stay close to home, wherever they started.
Okay, and is this true for the people that are poor and people that have more means?
Well, it depends. I mean, you have we're looking mostly at less affluent people in these studies.
Okay, and I mean, but let's define what does less affluent mean? Is it less than, you know, like what is in the Bay Area? Are we talking about the poor? Or are we talking about the middle class poor? I mean, and I put that in quotation marks. Who are we? Describe who you're talking about.
Well, if we go 50% of area median income, and now I'm looking at Steve because maybe he has the area median income figure in his head, which I don't. But the family median income in 2010, according to HUD, is about 90,000.
Okay,
that's pretty high. So we have a lot of working poor, and then we have a lot of very poor.
So when we're talking about the mobility and the numbers of people leaving, are we talking about this 90,000 income family, or are we talking about the people that are?
Good question. So the mobility, I would hypothesize that the mobility by choice is more the working poor that bought into the whole subprime American dream mortgage thing. And so those are the folks that wanted to be in the suburbs, and a lot of them are immigrant families with very large families and wanting the big yard and so forth. It's the very low income that we worry about in terms of choice.
Right. And so the 33,000 blacks are now, is there an assumption that who are these people?
Well,
I think that people, when they, you know, it's not surprising. Some people might think, oh, this is the poor, but that's not true.
This is also, Steve pointed out, we don't really have data on where they came from, where they're going. So it could be just a generational thing. I mean, we have a lot of older folks dying out and new folks coming in, and not all the population change and racial change is due to displacement per se. Some of it is this just changing of the population.
Yeah, this is Carl.
Okay. Hi, Carl. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here and happy to participate in this discussion. I think there was a real challenge, however, because the numbers give us something of a picture of what's going on, but there are other things that are going on. For example, I think the absence of a kind of civic culture that really enables people to fully participate is really one of the underlying things. It's not only the money, it is the money, but we basically have African Americans who really want to be part of the American dream. But they're forced to move out because they can't afford the housing in some places. And there's this expression, I think, among many people who work on housing issues, say that you drive till you qualify. That is, you because you only have a certain amount of money to pay for housing, you have to move further and further out in order to be able to buy a house. And one of the things that I think is particularly tragic about this pattern that we're seeing now is that many of the most ambitious people who are leaving the inner city because they want to be able to participate fully in the American dream are going to find themselves, when the gas prices go up, and in poor suburban places that have not even the level of amenity that of the places they left.
So do you, what do you make of the census data? Do you have, do you feel the same as Karen and Steve, or do you have a different take on it?
Well, I mean, I think the basic issue is that the country has not really come to terms with the issues of race. And we're now going through a new period where there's reinvestment in the inner cities, and it's being driven by a lot of new dynamics, for example, reducing greenhouse gas emissions and trying to get people out of their cars. But the messages have not really necessarily engaged African Americans, who in many places were located more centrally, who are seeing a chance to participate in the American dream and then finding that the rug is being pulled out from under them. You mentioned the foreclosure crisis. It's really tragic that people lose their savings, they invest in housing and then find themselves without any capacity to actually recover the down payments they made on these houses.
Now, the census, when they're trying to encourage people to take it, is really sold to people as like an opportunity to, if you do this, we're going to be able to get funding and things are going to be so much better if you participate. But how much, I mean, thinking back even 10 years ago, how much did the data drive? I know Steve mentioned that, you can get funding from it, but how much did it really drive improvements and how much didn't matter because the economy is with the economy. Carl,
I think there's a substantial evidence about predatory lending. I mean, and the fact of the matter is that many of these folks who moved out would not have qualified for mortgages under a less predatory regime, were in a sense convinced that they could make their payments if they worked really hard. And so there was enormous energy put into purchasing a house and finding a way of life in the suburbs, in many cases with longer and longer commutes. And in the end, because of the predatory conditions that under which the loans were made, people found themselves without the resource to make balloon payments and so forth.
Okay. Karen?
I think the issue here in terms of funding is we do use the census data quite a bit to determine how to spend our community development block grants, where should our social services go. And not only that, there's a whole array of nonprofits and that are deciding where to locate and foundations that are funding them. And they're all looking at this data on poverty. And they're looking for concentrations of poverty and concentrations of disadvantage. And one of the issues that we're having is that we're becoming more diverse, and this is a wonderful thing for the Bay Area, right? We're seeing the suburbs open up and become more diverse. At the same time, that's diluting the communities of disadvantage. And so it's harder to make an argument that we should locate these social services here. We should put that nonprofit here in the middle of, Brentwood to serve the 5% of people that are poor there. And so then what is going to be the community development capacity out in these types of areas?
It's interesting. I was under the impression that, I hear about the diversity, but that also that like is kind of coming, like people are kind of gravitating toward like places too. And I see Steve shaking his head.
Nodding.
Nodding, excuse me, yes. Steve, do you
have a feeling? There definitely is a lot of that happening. Last year we convened a group through the Bay Area Blacks in Philanthropy to look at the previous census data and the American Community Survey data up to mid-decade, to look at the regional changes within the African-American communities in the Bay Area, and specifically looking at, and this was before Census 2010, unfortunately, specifically looking at changes across the region that the philanthropic sector had not gotten a hold of. There were actually a lot of communities where that had a significant increase in African American population that funders really weren't aware of. So they may be operating in Napa and Solano counties and didn't realize that there actually had been, over the last 15 or 20 years, very large increases in the African American population in cities like Fairfield and Antioch. Yet those funders that were supporting the black community weren't aware that there was a growing population of citizens that they were concerned about, the conditions of life for those people in those communities. And so the census data for that is critical to be able to understand what does your community look like and where are the people that you're trying to serve living or going to. And if you're a foundation that's concerned about issues of urban poverty, you may have focused on Oakland for the last 30 years, but if a lot of poorer families that were renting with the foreclosure crisis, a lot of renters have been kicked out, even though there are laws on the books that prevent that from happening, it's still occurring at really high rates. So those families were renters, and they had even less capital and less protection because they didn't have wealth to begin with, are renters, and they've been pushed to outlying suburbs as well. Yet the philanthropy community that is concerned about the well-being of those citizens wasn't really aware that those citizens had been pushed out in growing numbers. And so the census data is crucial for us to understand really who is in our community and what does it look like. And as far as like attracting like, there's definitely a lot of areas of Oakland that are gentrifying and that is becoming a less diverse neighborhood, whereas other neighborhoods are becoming more diverse. And things are slowly shifting. And sometimes that's a good, healthy thing. And sometimes that results in an equitable sort of displacement of people from those communities because they can't afford the rent or because they're losing their homes to foreclosure. And what's happening now in West Oakland in particular, a lot of homes are being bought up by investment firms that are buying 150 properties in a concentrated area of West Oakland, and those properties are now sitting there blighted. And the families that live nearby, their property values are dropping even more. The neighborhood attracts more crime because there's a sense of sort of mayhem because there's all these blighted vacant properties. So the census data is really important for us to understand. Even though there are serious limitations with new census data, we need to know who is where and what, and then that drives the service delivery, whether it's locating nonprofits or whether it's providing government services. And then the trick for philanthropy, again, is you may put all your dollars into an organization that's based downtown Oakland, but where are they actually serving people? Are they serving people throughout deep East Oakland, or are they just serving people around Lower San Antonio, Central East Oakland? So there's a lot of issues that census data helps us to be able to understand and drive decisions that really fit the need in the community.
If you're just joining us, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the 2010 Alameda County Census results and its impact. Joining me tonight are Steve Spiker, the Director of Research and Technology at Urban Strategies Council, a social justice, community building and support nonprofit based in Oakland, Karen Chappell, Associate Professor of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley, and also serves as Associate Director of the Institute of Urban and Regional Development and the Director of the Center for Community Innovation, Carl Anthony, co-founder and former executive director of Urban Habitat Program, one of the nation's oldest environmental justice organizations, and Paloma Favell, founder and president of Earth House, former director of the strategic communications for the Sustainable Metropolitan Communities. If you'd like to join us, here is the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. We'd like to know from you, are you noticing these kinds of changes in your community? Do you feel that there's diversity, or do you feel that there's no diversity at all? Please give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
One of the paradoxes, I think,
yes, Carl.
This is Carl Anthony. One of the paradoxes in the current situation is the huge transformation that's going on internally within the African American community. We have, after all, now an African American president. We have many people who are succeeding according to the norms of mainstream American society. But we also have a very large segment of the working poor and the middle class who are hanging by their fingernails to just simply be part of the economy and the mainstream political reality that we're all engaged in. And then we also have a large number of African Americans who are just simply being flushed down the toilet. I mean, we have folks that are in the prison system, the criminal justice system. If you look at the University of California, the African-American population is virtually evaporated at the University of California, even though it's a public institution. So in this crisis, it's actually creating also a crisis of voice, because when during the days of segregation, and I'm not really advocating that we go back to those days, but during the days when African-Americans were concentrated in locations that were central, there was the capacity to actually have a unified voice about how to change the institutions and society. And right now, this is being severely threatened.
So let me bring in Paloma Pavel. You're the founder and president of Earth House, and I'm curious, what do you see that the communities that are being created, that they have, how would you describe them? Do you feel like there's enough regional equity?
Thank you, Lauren. The word community is really critical here. And I think that it's something that, we use it in kind of passing ways lightly. And I think it's a huge longing right now that people really are feeling extremely vulnerable with the economy, increasingly vulnerable with the environmental devastation that's occurring and the loss of cheap gas, a sense of things that we really thought were possible eroding before us, growing gaps of rich and poor. And there's this huge longing for what has all this struggle been for, and what is possible now? So the sense of community, what we're seeing are a rise of certain new community institutions like farmers markets, and we're finding that these farmers markets are becoming amazingly resilient places where in communities of color and in poorer areas, places that have been food deserts up till now, that are kind of tapping into this sense of a longing to be able to walk, be able to see one another, be able to have music, be able to exchange, whether it's goods and services, take care of basic needs like food, but also there is this longing for community that I think we're seeing in a new way. And it's also one of the places where, as communities are becoming more fragmented, as Karen was describing, where communities of color who had some concentrated culture are being dispersed, or class divides are happening within racial groups that previously had more solidarity by place. I think what we're seeing is a huge longing for a deeper, more meaningful sense of what community can be, and a reaching for that in different ways.
This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Lauren Meltzer. If you're just tuning in, we're discussing the impact of the 2010 Alameda County Census and also talking about communities and what they really are at this point. Joining me tonight are Steve Spiker, the Director of Research and Technology at Urban Strategies Council, a social justice community building and support nonprofit based in Oakland, Karen Chappell, Associate Professor of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley, and also an Associate Director of the Institute of Urban and Regional Development and the Director of the Center for Community Innovation. Carl Anthony, co-founder and former executive director of the Urban Habitat Program, one of the nation's oldest environmental justice organizations, and Paloma Pavel, founder and president of Earth House and a former director of strategic communications for the Sustainable Metropolitan Communities. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Do you find that community in your area seems to be increasing, the sense of community, or do you feel that it really has gotten fragmented? Please give us a call, 415-841-4134. I want to go back to you, Karen. You mentioned that we talked about kind of the diversity, and then we're also talking about the fragmentation. Are there things as a regional planner that are being done looking forward to think about as an urban planner to help with this? You know, we talk, Paloma mentioned things that the community is doing, like farmers markets, but is there things as a planner that are being done?
Well, I think Carl already made reference to the issue of transportation and the fact that transportation costs are much higher for folks living in the outer suburbs. So we are starting, one of the things that's going on in planning right now, and Carl can speak to this just as well as I can, is we're starting to think about families in terms of the family budget. We're starting to think about them much more holistically. So for years, thinking about, housing affordability, we just thought about, what was 30% of your income. You know, that's what you're supposed to spend on housing. Well, we need to think about transportation. We need to think about food. We need to think about health care increasingly as part of the family budget for the 37 million or whatever it is uninsured. So so if planners start thinking about these family lives more holistically, it means a whole different set of priorities for planning, and particularly more investment in transit, more investment in bike and pedestrian facilities, more accessibility in suburban areas generally.
And so, oh, I'm sorry, Paloma? Or Carl?
Yeah, I wanted to say that there's a deep underlying shift that is going on now that also needs to be sort of considered in this process, because we're living in a time, some people call it the post-industrial era. Many of the African Americans who migrated to the cities did so because, for example, during the Second World War in the Bay Area, many African Americans came to work in the shipyards. And it was a sort of flowering of the peaking level of the industrial development in the country that actually drew people from the cotton fields and the sugarcane fields to these cities. And now that sort of foundation of economic opportunity is really dissipating all over the world. At the same time, it's really creating huge problems of displacement in many developing countries. So we have a migration of folks from Central America, Mexico, Southeast Asia, and the Caribbean coming in seeking for opportunities from where they have been displaced. So I think it's really important to point out that the fundamental economic viability of our urban places, which in a sense grew up around the Industrial Revolution, is now being challenged by many new patterns, and that the individuals who are coping with this are forced to really conceptualize what their goals and what their hopes are. And many African Americans are migrating even back to the South. And I think it's also really important to understand that the Latino population that's moving from Mexico and from Central America are highly motivated to actually improve the quality of their life, and in many ways have a more cohesive sense of who they are, at least in the first generation. And this is also true from many Asian American Pacific Islanders who come to the Bay Area.
And Ms. Tiespacher?
Yeah, and Carl, that raises another point for me around the migration issues. When we look at the census data really clumsily groups people into this African American or black category. And then what that doesn't tell people that are concerned about issues of regional equity and planning is that if you are a successful Nigerian family with three doctors, which happens to be a friend of mine, you are not in the same situation income-wise or education-wise as someone that has been living in Baby Hunter's Point, that's had parents that worked in the shipyards that are now suffering from not great healthcare in that community, lack of access to equity and opportunity. You may be categorized the exact same way by the census as a black person or an African American, but you're not the same person. And the census data now is when we have increasing migration from Ethiopia and Sudan, Nigeria, that isn't capturing that anymore. And that's an issue for us when we talk about what our communities, who is in our communities. We're not talking about the same people in the same way. We're lumping everyone into this same crude category, whereas really those people are not all the same people. They've got a different experience. They've got different opportunities and accesses to opportunity in their background, yet the census just lumps them into one clump. And we now have to look at across our region, where is the African American and Black community? But we're not talking about the same thing. We're using that same term to refer to vastly different groups of people. And as Carl said, there's growing disparities within the African American community. A lot more people are making it. They're getting access to wealth and they're growing wealth. And that's not the same when you consider that person's opportunities and their outcomes compared to someone that's living in deep East Oakland, bad quality education, not many jobs available. It's a very different experience. Yet, according to the census, when we're just looking at race, they're all the same, and that's just not
helpful. Why
do
they group it at this point when that's not the reality of today's world?
That's a good question.
We'll leave it at that.
I'm not happy with their answers.
Carl?
This is Carl. Yeah, I think following up on that point, we also have a huge surge in mixed race families.
Sure.
As well as non-traditional families of all sorts. And so we're facing a level of complexity that requires almost a new paradigm. And I think we haven't really come to terms with that. At the same time, the most vulnerable populations, particularly, again, the African-American community, that you've got to really picture the fact that African-Americans have been in North America for 10 generations. And before even the U.S. government was set up. And so at this point, to find oneself marginalized after all this time raises some very serious questions about whether or not, as a society, we really have the capacity to really engage with African Americans as part of the human community. And, you know, when you look at the 19th century, there was, after the Civil War, many African Americans expected to be able to fully participate. And we had waves of immigrants who came in at that point and essentially displaced the African Americans from a central role. So we were facing a number of paradoxes. And I think in general, many of us who struggle with these issues are really embrace the human rights perspective. And we think that the immigrants have a full right to all of the civic opportunities that exist in the culture. And yet we are, you know, are saddened by the fact that the country has not been able to deal with the paradox of race as it affects African Americans.
Interesting. If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the 2010 Alameda County Census and also the impact that it has and doesn't have on the changing communities. Joining me tonight are Steve Spiker, the Director of Research and Technology at the Urban Strategies Council, a social justice community building and support nonprofit based in Oakland, Karen Chappell, Associate Professor of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley, and also Associate Director of the Institute of Urban and Regional Development, and the Director of the Center for Community Innovation, Carl Anthony, co-founder and former Executive Director of the Urban Habitat Program, one of the nation's oldest environmental justice organizations, and Paloma Pavel, the founder Paloma, the founder and president of Earth House. If you want to be part of this conversation, we would love to hear from you. We'll be taking calls at 415-841-4134 or emails at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And we do have a couple of emails. I do want to get to some emailers. We have Liz from Berkeley. She says, can the infrastructure in suburbs support migration? And I think that this is a little what you guys have been alluding to. Karen, do you want to?
This is the issue in terms of transportation and that transportation costs are so much higher there because we don't have the public infrastructure. But it's not just transportation. We're also talking about public space. Schools, are schools ready to accommodate growing diversity? A variety of different services that are, you know, the infrastructure we've come to take for granted in San Francisco and Oakland.
Well, I also think the question of jobs is really a critical variable in all this. And we've seen over the last 50 years the jobs are moving further and further out in the suburbs. And yet, I think it's really important for the radio audience to appreciate the fact that we are, in a sense, looking at a new context for addressing the issues of our cities. And one of the biggest things that's happening in California with urban and metropolitan planning is the recognition that our pattern of suburban sprawl is actually causing a lot of the greenhouse gas emissions and global warming. Mm-hmm. And so there's a statewide initiative to really try to reduce the number of people who are relying on automobiles. And there's a great discussion about how do we get more compact urban development around places where transit is available. And one of the paradoxes that we're really having to confront in this is that the way in which this process is unfolding, and we at Breakthrough Communities have been very deeply involved in it, has not been very aggressive in addressing issues of social and racial justice. And the paradox may well be that after a brief period of several decades of African Americans moving to the cities in search of opportunity, we may find ourselves in a situation like people in developing countries, where the poor people are living out on the periphery and the rich people are living in the inner city with all of the amenity and all the support system of being able to have walkable neighborhoods and high quality of life. And if we see this reversal, it'll be really sad, because the opportunity to address the issues of social and racial justice will have been missed.
Okay. And Steve,
I would like to say something in response to Liz, really brought up a very powerful word, infrastructure. And when she asked about infrastructure in the suburbs, can it support the migration patterns that are occurring? What we're discovering is that the infrastructure everywhere is in trouble, that we have literally sewer pipes that are 75 years old. We don't have the means to replace the infrastructure that has been there for some time. And infrastructure, at the same time that it's being revealed how vulnerable we actually are, everywhere. This is not a suburb-only problem. This is local communities don't have money to make repairs that are needed. But as we begin to face this, and I want to call the audience to the attention of a film that we've had the opportunity to work on in the last few years with filmmaker Andrea Tarice. It's a film called Crack in the Pavement that addresses precisely the infrastructure challenge that we're all facing right now. And as populations are moving and the property tax base that has supported infrastructure is declining, this is becoming an emergency issue in many communities. However, the solution is also in the problem that many communities are now having to really look at and say, what is important? What constitutes a healthy community? What constitutes a safe but viable community? And people are beginning to engage in these conversations of, given that we have scarce dollars, where do we put them and how do we deal with our infrastructure needs? And what constitutes the infrastructure that really does support life? Is it a library? Is it a park, a green space? You know, what is it that we are longing for in creating community and community development? And how do we support one another at a regional level to have communities that are viable, that are sustainable, and that are healthy?
Steve, did you want to add to this?
Yeah, sure. Jumping back a little to what Carl said, the infrastructure issues and the question, the infrastructure issue gets reversed in a very messy way in these urban centers that we are seeing some out-migration from and into. Take, for example, an area of West Oakland. If you have an increasing number of young, up-and-coming folks moving into that area, Jerry Brown obviously did a lot of attractive promotion of West Oakland for folks from San Francisco to use as a housing base. So we have younger folks moving out into that neighborhood, and as a result, we've got a drop in the age of the population but an increase in income. What we also have is less families in that neighborhood. which has the impact that the school district now has lower enrollment in the school system, which means less money. So the school systems, which are already struggling, and Oakland especially, are faced with less money, so they have to cut back, consider cutting back teachers, closing schools, and consolidating schools. So we're now seeing it. Last year we saw the first increase in population in the OUSD for a long time. But we're talking about a decrease in the number of kids in the system and less money. But in a few years' time, and this has happened even in our office, when I started 5 years ago, zero kids in the office, and now there are about five or six staff with young kids that they've had in the last few years. So there's a lot of those young folks that have moved into Oakland in particular are now starting to meet up and have families. And those families in the next few years are going to need schools. And if we've had to close schools and consolidate and cut back the school district because there aren't families that justify the funding, we're then faced with those new families looking at decisions of, well, this neighborhood maybe isn't safe enough, and there aren't schools that are there with the capacity that I want anymore, and so I'm now going to move out of that area. And so we're looking at very fast, very dynamic changes in the urban fabric, and this is almost impossible for policymakers to deal with because they and us aren't used to dealing with such big changes on such very short frames of time.
How long has it been this way? How often has it been? I mean, for how long have there been such quick changes?
From my perspective, the changes are becoming much more rapid. Obviously, I'm probably the youngest in the conversation. I'm the newest resident of the U.S., so my perspective is a little shorter than others. But it definitely seems like these things are happening much faster than they did in the past. There was a lot more stability. In previous generations, there wasn't as much mobility. So that, to me, and the research that we've done, this is speeding up a lot of these changes.
I think also that... This is Carl again. I think also we're confronting a challenge of an aging European-American population who have health needs as they get older. And there's also the potential of a real split in terms of our priorities, whether we take care of the older people or whether we take care of the younger people. And as the younger people are increasingly people of color, their needs are very important. But then the question of the people who are in a position to make decisions may not have the empathy that is needed in order to bring that generation on. So we're really at a crossroads, I think, in terms of how we think about all these things.
If you're just joining us, this is City Visions, and tonight we're discussing the 2010 Alameda County Census. Joining me are Steve Spiker, Director of Research and Technology at Urban Strategies Council, Karen Chappell, Associate Professor of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley, and also an Associate Director of the Institute of Urban and Regional Development and the Director of the Center for Community Innovation. We have Carl Anthony, co-founder and former executive director of Urban Habitat Program, one of the nation's oldest environmental justice organizations, and lastly, Paloma Pavel, founder and president of Earth House and former director of strategic communications for the Sustainable Metropolitan Communities. If you'd like to join us, here is the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let me go to another email we have. This is from Danny from the East Bay, and he wants to know, he asks, how does the Bay Area metro regions compare to the rest of the U.S.? Karen Chappell, can you answer that?
Sure, and then I'm sure Carl and Paloma and Steve can jump in. So we are one of the most affluent areas in the country. We're also one of the most unequal areas in the country. And so Carl was talking about this change where the center city is dominated by the rich and the poor on the fringe, like in Europe, and the opposite is happening in many of the Midwestern areas where you have the hollowing out of the middle, the decline, disinvestment in the middle, and the sprawl, and those being very, very much related. So the regional equity movements have really taken different characters in these different places. And again, this is something Paloma should jump in on. It's that the strong markets, we're fighting gentrification. In Detroit, the story's a little different, right?
Okay. Paloma, do you want to jump in?
Thank you. What Karen's referencing is we've just completed 10 years of working with community groups across regions in the United States, and also trying to create a support system by which groups that are learning frontline strategies that are successful can share those with other groups. And those are documented in our book, Breakthrough Communities. So what is a breakthrough community? One of the things that we're learning about is that breakthrough communities are often communities of color who are able to create unexpectedly creative alliances and forge partnerships with groups that they previously may not have worked with, like environmental groups. And in the story of Detroit, in particular, a group of faith-based organizers have been successful in establishing a regional transportation plan and addressing the vacant property situation, where there are 90,000 vacant properties in the center of Detroit, and where people have increasingly had sort of a white flight to the outer suburbs, to the point where it's now dysfunctional for everyone. So people can't, there are too many homes being built. There isn't the market to purchase the homes that are being built. And these areas are becoming so dispersed that everyone is seeing that it's now in their interest to work together. And outer suburban churches have been linking with inner city groups, and they are actually creating a citizens-driven transportation plan that is beginning to be adopted by the city itself.
Yeah, and I think also you spoke with
Carl Anthony.
Right. Yeah, this is Carl Anthony. The book Breakthrough Community Sustainability and Justice in the Next American Metropolis that Dr. Pavel has edited, and I supplied a foreword to this book, really has case studies of different places around the country that have many, many different types of stresses. Some in the South, and we know what happened. Many of us have been paying attention to what's happened in New Orleans, which is rapid transformation that's going on in the wake of Katrina. In New England, the pattern's really quite different. Chicago managed to survive in much of the fate of some of the industrial cities because of the immigration of new populations. So we have a pattern across the country that has many similarities across metropolitan regions, but also many differences depending on their position in the global marketplace and in the U.S. Continent.
Carl, Steve Spiker mentioned, talked about the rapid changes in the cities in terms of the demographics. Do these breakthrough communities, I guess this would be a question to Paloma too, are they able to then move with the nimble changes in the communities, or since the government and policy probably can't react to reflect what's really happening?
Well, I think the experience that we've had around the country has been when communities are able to organize, that is to say, when they're able to build on their nonprofit sector and the sort of, Dick Tocqueville talked about this, where people are actually able to come together outside of the government framework and begin to build political alliances and then work together to actually make, force the cities and the suburbs to behave in their own self-interest, we begin to see kind of this breakthroughs. And we've seen really some astounding examples of this across the country that are documented in this book.
Now, there has been this, there was this model of smart growth that, Karen, I think you referred to. How much of that is happening at this point, and how much of it is kind of not, it's kind of nice in theory, but not really taking place? Karen, maybe
of course, nobody expected the bottom to drop out of the economy.
Exactly.
So I think to some extent, the smart growth movement was based on some of the strength in the economy at a moment when the housing market was a totally different shape than it is right now. But I believe, and I would be interested in other people's opinion, I believe that the fundamental premise of smart growth is really solid, in that it really is a pattern that we really should be moving toward in terms of reducing our reliance on automobiles, building community, creating public transit, really looking at our food system, But the smart growth movement has been, very much like the environmental movement, has been somewhat flawed in the sense that it's grown out of the European-American middle class, and it's only recently that the issues of communities of color and issues of social justice have begun to surface as sort of main drivers of smart growth. And I think we're going to see more and more of that, especially as we are having to come to terms with an urbanizing world, that people are leaving the rural places and moving to cities. We're going to see more people of color and more social justice activists embracing smart growth and social justice as elements of sustainability.
Karen Chappell, what
we're seeing right now, a vast change in consumer preferences, and there's a good deal of demographic data showing a new preference for smart growth and a new preference for urban living and higher densities and in bigger cities. Now, the problem, though, is that we don't yet have the policy infrastructure to support these emerging markets. And in fact, we have markets, the banks and underwriters themselves, that entire financing system is not set up to support these kinds of preferences. So we have a lot of work to do.
Okay. And Steve Spiker, in regards to, you know, what you've been seeing and with the census data getting back, do you see, I mean, can that at all give input in terms of, like, in the next 10 years, whether smart growth would make sense, or is it just completely unrelated and really the factors that the others have been talking about are really going to...
I don't think it would discredit the idea of smart growth at all. It definitely has... it has highlighted some of the complications that some of the modeling that has been done maybe wasn't able to deal with, things like a foreclosure crisis, like an economic slump. So those things were nigh on impossible to predict, although folks at Greenlining were talking about an upcoming foreclosure crisis for a decade now. So those things have made some of the efforts more complicated, and they've made some of the financing structures to allow these things to happen a little more further off than we would have liked. But I don't think there's anything coming out of the census that would discredit the idea. When we get more accurate census data in June and July, that'll help us to build a little deeper understanding of just really the nuance of these changes. So right now we know some macro level changes, but we don't know enough about who is moving where right now to really understand, are some of these models needing tweaking, or do they need to be heavily realigned based on some shifts we didn't expect?
Well, Steve, one of the things that you said earlier on, I think, is a really good example of what you're talking about, and that is, if you look at the movement of the African-American population, not only in Alameda County, but also in the San Francisco County, up to places like Antioch and Pittsburgh and Fairfield, you basically have this population that's moving to suburban places that are not really engaged in any kind of smart growth activity. People are moving to suburban communities that have no job base and no economic base, have transportation problems that are not really, haven't even been addressed. They have no fiscal capacity. The school systems have no capacity to actually provide for the next generation of young people. And yet,
well, Carl, I'm going to have to, unfortunately, we'd love to keep talking about this. This is such an important next step, but we're at the top of the hour, and that's it for City Visions. I'd like to thank our guests, Steve Spiker, the Director of Research and Technology at Urban Strategies Council, and Karen Chappell, Associate Professor of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley, Carl Anthony, co-founder and former Executive Director of the Urban Habitat Program, and Paloma Pavel, founder and president of Earth House. Thank you all for coming on our show tonight. Big, meaty topics.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much. Thanks, Lauren.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, and to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Tonight, our engineer was Bob Summer. Thank you very much, Bob. And tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denenmark. Thank you very much, Lisa. City Vision's founder is Rose Levinson. Judith Sanson is our senior producer. Our other contributing producers are Shashi Patel, Susie Britton, and Yumi Wilson. Join City Visions next week when we'll explore San Francisco's bike plans. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thank you for listening. Good night and have a great week.